Evening, everybody. My name is Travis. I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here tonight. Glad to be sober. Billy, thank you for the invitation. I got sober on July the 10th of 1999, which feels like a galaxy far, far away at this point. I have a sponsor. His name is Thomas, and he does know he's my sponsor. That's an important aspect of that relationship, that they know that they're your sponsor. And I have a home group. It's the Darnestown Men's Meeting. We meet on Saturday mornings at 8:30 in the morning. And if you're ever up in that area, please come see us if you're a guy. Just saying. But like I said, I'm really glad to be here tonight. And as a friend of mine used to say all the time, fully clothed and in my right mind. You know, because it wasn't always that way for a guy like me. And I got sober when I was 22 years old. I was just telling these guys before the meeting, like, I crossed this strange threshold a few years ago where I've now been sober and active in Alcoholics Anonymous over half my life, which is kind of crazy, you know. And when I was new, sometimes people would say to me things like, oh, you're so lucky you got sober young. And I know they were well-intentioned, and I know kind of in a general way what they meant and everything, but sometimes I would say, I'm like, do you know how bad it has to be to get sober at 22? Do you understand what that is like? You know, and usually they didn't, and that's fine and whatnot. I grew up in a small town in Ohio. I came from a loving home. We were pretty poor when I was a kid, and we didn't have a lot, but we had plenty of love, and we had most of the things that we needed. And maybe a thing here or there that we wanted, you know, and I always like to say that there was never a lack of love in my home. My parents taught me right from wrong. They tried to raise me right and all that stuff. And I don't know, somewhere around the age of maybe four, I decided that I came to the conclusion that I was in the wrong family, and that I clearly was adopted, though I was not adopted. But I just never really quite felt like I fit in with them. Now, hindsight being 2020, my dad and I have almost identical personalities. So maybe I just didn't like him because he was so much like me. I don't know. But we moved to the DC area when I was nine. And leading up to that, you know, when we moved, man, that was, you want to talk about a culture shock. I was a fish out of water. I talked funny, you know, in comparison to everybody else. And, I certainly did not have any of the stylish clothes that these other kids were wearing and whatnot. And so for me at that age, one of the things that I found was sports, with athletics. And I found out that I was a fairly gifted athlete. I mean, you know, it doesn't take much at nine, but I was pretty good at sports. And the thing that I loved about sports was that we all had to wear the same uniform. And it really, you know, you didn't get made fun of for the clothes you were wearing, and I liked that, and people acted like they liked me because I was good at sports. So I really kind of went down that road, and you know, by the time I'm in high school, I had already been sent away to military school, actually not too far from here, Fork Union. I was there for a year and a half, and you know, all of seventh grade and half of eighth grade, and you know, and during that time, the reason why they sent me away is because I kept getting caught like smoking and all this stuff at like 12, you know, and my grades weren't great. And so they're like, you need some discipline in your life, which apparently I needed some discipline in my life. And that's what I got. And I remember during the time that I was there, I felt like I was no longer a member of my family. Like I was some sort of an outsider. And so all those feelings I'd had kind of growing up almost were like confirmed, you know, like I really am an outsider. I really don't belong here. And I also kind of made this decision that I didn't really care what my parents said or what they told me to do. I was going to live life on my terms and, you know, consequences be damned. And that's what I did, you know, coming into high school, I played ball and I had to keep my grades up to play ball. And I loved sports by this time. I really, truly was very passionate about it and loved it. And, you know, I got to, like I said, in the fall, I was playing football, and in the spring I was playing baseball. And as a freshman in high school, I had college scouts looking at me to play. at the next level and all this stuff. And I was able to keep my grades up because I wanted to play sports. And so that was my freshman year. By the end of my sophomore year, I had quit all sports. And here's the thing about that. It would be really easy for me to tell you that drinking took that away from me or something like that, but that's not my case. Maybe it's yours, but it's not mine. What happened with me is that I had these decisions to make almost on a daily basis. Am I going to go to practice and get yelled at and run and sweat and all this stuff? Or am I going to go drink a six pack and get a sense of a job well done without having to do a damn thing? And that was a pretty easy choice for me. And so it's not like I said to myself, I'm gonna throw away any kind of athletics. I'm gonna throw away scholastic achievement or anything like that. I just said, I want to take a drink. I like that feeling that I get from taking a drink. And so that's what happened. And so over time, while I was in high school, thing after thing, I keep tearing off little pieces of my being, little pieces of my soul, little pieces of my life, and just throwing it in the ring. Can I keep drinking if I give you this? Can I keep drinking if I give you this? And that's the way it went for me. I things got not great, and then they got worse. And by the time I'm 17 years old, really 16, I started getting into physical altercations with my dad. Not proud of that, but that's what I did. And I remember being 17 years old, and my dad and I were about to get into it again, and he kind of just stopped. He said, "You know what, Travis? We have rules in this house, and if you don't want to follow them, there's the door." Now, in 17 years of life, it had never occurred to me that I could leave. Like that was an option. I was like, "Really?" And what seemed like, I guess, to them as like some sort of a threat to me was this magical aha moment of yes. And so within an hour, I packed up all my stuff and left. I had no car, I had no license or anything, but I knew somewhere in the back of my fevered brain that if I could just get away from these people and their, puritanical rules, that maybe I could be okay. And so for the next year, I had enough money. I had, work, and I also did things on the side I'm not going to get into, but I had enough money to do whatever I wanted to do. I was living with a friend, and his mom always treated me like her other son. And so I had a place to live, and had enough money to do whatever I wanted. My grades actually got a little bit better, which is weird, but that's what happened. And I just tried to kind of make my way in the world. About a year after that, I'm approaching my 18th birthday, and that friend and his family, they're moving. I said, "You're welcome to go with us if you want." I said, I don't think I want to do that." So I went and I talked to my folks, and "Hey, I need a place to go and this and that." And they being being them, being parents, they wanted me to be home. I do believe that. And they had some requirements, though. They said, "You if you're going to be here, you cannot drink or drug. You certainly can't bring any of that stuff into the house. And we want you to go to two AA meetings a week." And my mom, being my mom, she was like, I even found a couple of them for you. There's one on Sunday and one on Tuesday. They're, a few blocks away. You could even walk to it." So, okay. So I start going to these AA meetings again on Sunday and Tuesday. They're at 8:30 in the evening. So I showed up promptly at about 7, or excuse me, about 8:27, 8:28. And I would sit in the back row and watch all this that's going on. And, with my keen alcoholic mind, and by the way, the only place you're ever going to hear about your keen alcoholic mind is in AA. Other people don't call it that. I would sit in the back, and I'll never forget this. It was like my second or third meeting, and they gave out chips at this meeting, or medallions, whatever you want to call it. And it was like halftime. And I'm sitting in the back row, and the guy, they get 1 month, 2 month, three, anyway, they get up to 5 years. And I could see it like it was yesterday in my mind's eye. The guy was sitting two rows in front of me, three seats to the left. And he called 5 years, and this guy stands up. And the whole place said, "Woo! Yeah! Wow!" Going crazy, like he hit the lottery, And I'm sitting there watching this stuff, and I'm thinking to myself, that is a terrible idea. Why in God's name would you not drink for 5 years? And why would you be happy about that? And so in my mind, I was not like these people. They're happy about not drinking. not drinking for me is a punishment. And that's exactly how I looked at it. This is the consequence, is not drinking. And I quickly discovered that if I just smoke a joint on the way to the meeting, I've made it a lot easier. So I came out of that experience completely unscathed by sobriety because I wasn't sober. I was 17 years old. Like I said, it was a couple months before I turned 18. When I turned 18, and that was the agreement with my folks, was that I would live there until I turned 18. And that was it. And it was around this time of year, actually. My birthday's in December, you know, and so, you know, the reason why I went and talked to them is because I might be crazy, but I ain't stupid. It's getting cold outside. You know what I mean? And I want to live indoors. So the agreement was when I turned 18, I would leave. And I did. I went back to that small town in Ohio where I had grown up. And I got a job, but I didn't just get any job. I got a terrible job because I'm good at doing that too. And I worked in this fiberglass factory, you know, and which is also known as the seventh realm of hell. It was not great. And we worked 10-hour shifts, and I worked the, you know, what they call the mid or the swing. And so it was like 3 p.m. until 1 o'clock in the morning. And there was this drive-through beer store on my way home, you know, because the factory was out on the edge of town, and I had to go through town and to get home. And anyway, it was supposed to close at 1. They would stay open a little while longer, maybe 15 minutes or whatever, because a lot of the guys from the factory would come and go through the line and get beer or, you know, whatever, alcohol. And I just had my car, just got in line. You know what I mean? I was like 18 years old, and I thought, well, the worst thing that's going to happen is I'm in the same exact situation that I'm in now and have no alcohol. The worst thing that's going to happen is they're going to tell me no. And they just didn't. They never asked, so I never said anything. And so every night after work, I would go and get beer and drink. And when I first moved to Ohio, I lived with my grandmother for about a month and a half, something like that. And I met this guy, and we rented an apartment. It was like an old farmhouse that had been converted into four apartments. And you know, we had no cable, and we lived outside of, this is a small town, and we lived outside of town. So there was no television stations that you were getting with rabbit ears or nothing, you know, but we did have a VCR, but we only had one movie. You know? So I watched the same movie every night, you know, and my life had become kind of like that movie Groundhog Day. That wasn't the movie, but my life was like that movie, in the sense of every day was the same. And I would start to convince myself, you know, as I'm going to bed, I'm like, you know, this has got to stop. You know what? Tomorrow I'm going to get up before 2, you know, like I'm going to get up at the crack of 11 and something, you know, something like that. And I'm going to eat a real meal. I'm going to go get a different movie, you know, and those feelings and those thoughts would still be with me the next morning. But as I'm driving to work, somehow, some way, I just don't feel as strong about it. And then I start to go through my work day, and then break time comes, and I'm sweaty. I'm not real amused with whatever, you know, fill in the blank of whatever the conflict du jour is for that day. And I start thinking, you know, I just need to take the edge off. And then I'm leaving work, and I'm in line again, you know, and it just kept happening over and over again. And eventually I got my first DUI there, and I decided that I didn't want to stick around for that, you know, and so I left, which is not a good idea, but that's what I did. And I came back here because it's so much better. I was promptly arrested within like 30 days or something. And, you know, the problem with that is that in those circumstances, you have no fixed address, which is another way of saying you're homeless, you know, and so they don't really release people with no fixed address on their own recognizance. So I got to stay in jail for a little while. And it's important for me to note that between the ages of 14 and 21, I was arrested 15 times. And so the charges kept getting more and more severe. And my stints of incarceration kept getting longer. You know, a lot of the stuff as a juvenile, they would talk real sternly, but not a lot happened, quite honestly, you know. And so as an adult, there was a bit of a wake-up call for a guy like me. And eventually, you know, they let me out, all this stuff. I got arrested a little bit later, and maybe 6, 9 months later. It was pretty serious this time. I was facing 32 felonies and another 32 conspiracy charges and a ringleader charge and all this stuff. And it was not good. You know, and I remember being incarcerated, and my public defender came and saw me, you know, and we had to talk about my case. And I was like, I added all this up, and apparently I'm facing 642 years. And she just kind of looked at me. I was like, I don't think I can do that much time, man. And she said, well, just do what you can do. All right. I'm like, oh, I don't like where this is going. You know, anyway, so what ends up happening out of that is that they didn't really have a lot of evidence, and I don't want to get into the details, but the one thing that they could get me on was a conspiracy charge. And so that was it. And that wasn't even a felony. Now, a rational person would probably say, man, that was close. I better, you know, straighten up and fly right. But I'm an idiot. So my thought pattern was, see, I'm just a little too slick. They should call me Teflon Travis, you know, which is really ridiculous. But this is kind of how my mind was working, and maybe still sometimes today, but nonetheless. So I went about my business, and you know, by this time I'm 19, and by the time I'm 20, things are not good. And it's also important for me to relay that I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said, at 17. And I would continue to visit AA from that time until I got sober at 22. You know, and that was a long 5 years. There's a lot that happened there. I did a lot of things I'm not proud of. And I'm very intentional with the word visit, that I was always a visitor. You know, because here's the thing. If you're a member, or at least in my experience, if I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, there are things that are expected of me. You know, if you have somebody, a guest over for dinner, you expect them to come over and have dinner, and that's about it. You know, if you have a guest over, you're probably going to prepare the meal. You're probably going to clean up and all that stuff, you know, because you're a member of that home. And that's how I looked at AA. I was a guest. And so I didn't do anything. You know, I thought I was going to sit in that chair and somehow, you know, drink your coffee and eat your cookies. And somehow I was going to get better. And then I never got better. In fact, usually what would happen is I would come to AA because the heat is on. And I, you know, the circumstances, the details may be different for all of us. But if I say the heat was on, everybody in this room knows what I'm talking about. So the heat was on and I'd go to AA. And it would usually be this cycle of about 3 weeks. It's about usual. The first week I would start to feel better physically in particular, because I was no longer poisoning myself in a very literal sense, you know. And then the second week would roll around and people would ask me crazy questions like, how are you doing? You know, and I didn't know how to answer that. And so I would say dumb things that made no sense. Like, I'm just trying to do the right thing. I have no idea what that means, you know. And then week three would roll around. And I don't know about you if you've ever tried to quit drinking, but when I would try to quit drinking, week three would roll around. What would happen to me is that everybody around me got a little stupider, you know, and they're moving slow and they're in my way. And life started to feel itchy, you know, kind of like a wool sweater, no undershirt. Itchy, you know, you just can't quite get away from it. Ugh. And I kept hearing in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, people would say, to drink is to die. You know, to drink is to die. Hey, to drink is to die. And after about 3 weeks, I can't take it anymore. I just can't take it anymore. And so I take a drink. And what happens? I don't die. In fact, what happens to me after 3 weeks of not drinking, I take a drink and then I go, and I can breathe again. And I can breathe again. And so in my mind, I'm not like you. Because for you, apparently, to drink is to die. For me, when I drink, I get the relief I need. And that kept me going back out time and time and time again. You know, and eventually what ended up happening was I set the all Travis world record for sobriety. It was 42 days. And I drank again. Yet again, right? And I thought, maybe I'm one of those people. Maybe I'm one of those people that just is constitutionally incapable. They can't get this thing, you know? And I kind of went off the deep end a little bit. And I cared very little whether I lived or died, and I cared even less whether you did. And like I said, I did a lot of things I'm not proud of, hurt a lot of people. And that was my life. And so for the next 6 months, I just ripped and run. And I think, you know, looking back on it in particular, in hindsight, it occurs to me that maybe I just hoped that I would die. And sometimes I would have that thought. Maybe I'll get lucky and I'll get hit by a bus tonight. You know, just not great thoughts. I was never particularly suicidal. I know, like, my wife, she's more like the suicidal type. I'm more the homicidal type. So, you know, I mean, we have a running joke in our home that if we ever start drinking again, that she'll be trying to kill herself and I'll probably be trying to help her. So we really hope that doesn't happen, you know. Nonetheless, what ended up happening for me is that I had a cocaine-induced heart attack shortly before my 21st birthday and almost died. And so I guess it's time to go to rehab. You know, never been to rehab. Maybe I should do that. And so I went to rehab. I turned 21 in rehab. And like I said, my birthday's in December. And so I spent my 21st birthday, Christmas, and New Year's all in rehab. And I got out, it was around middle of January. They told me, you know, they elected me president of the rehab community, which seems like it should be an honor, but maybe not, you know? And so as I'm getting ready to go back out into the world, I sat down with my counselor or whatever, and they said, you know, we almost never do this, but we're going to give you a good prognosis. We think you're going to be okay. Man, they could have signed my death warrant right there. If there's anything that's worse than bad news for an alcoholic, it's good news, you know? And I was like, yeah, that's right. I got this thing. Yeah. And there's an old saying, just when you think you got it, you're about to get it. And boy, boy, did I, you know? And like I said, I turned 21 when I was in there. I got out. I think it was either the next day or 2 days after I got out, my best friend from high school called me. And he said, Travis, man, I'm 21. It was his birthday. So, you know, we've been talking about this for years, and we had all kinds of grand plans about what we were going to do when we turned 21. And I said, you know, I just got out of rehab a couple of days ago. He said, yeah, no, that's great, man. So you're all rehabilitated now, right? I'm like, bro, that's not really how this works, you know? I've got mountains of evidence, you know. Basically, I politely got off the phone. Thanks, but no thanks. You know, it was a little more involved than that, but whatever. And I knew, because I knew in my mind that this is not good. This is not a good idea. You know, you almost died a month ago. And I've got mountains and mountains of evidence that drinking is a bad idea for Travis. Mountains of evidence, you know, real world experience, recent, you know, not like history lesson, like current events. And then I have this thought. You've never taken a legal drink. Now, come on. How can you be an alcoholic if you've never taken a legal drink? That's crazy. That's crazy. And you see, that's the insanity that's an example of the insanity that you're talking about in that second step. You know? And like our literature describes, the insane idea won out and I drank again. And that particular night, I went to a bar. A buddy of mine, another friend from high school, was bartending there. And he was serving us for free. So I just gave him whatever cash I had as a tip. And then I needed a ride home. Mind you, I'm living in what's known as an Oxford house. It's a sober environment. And they don't take kindly to people drinking. But I didn't care. That's me. I just didn't care. I never cared how I impacted other people. And so I needed a ride home, and that was a long way to walk. And I was like, oh, there's got to be another option. It's January. It's cold. It's snowing a little bit. And the bar was in a restaurant, and it was in the shopping center, and there was a grocery store there. Guy was loading groceries into the trunk of his car, but he left the car running because it's cold and snowy. And I was watching this, and I thought, what a fool. And so I walked past him. I got in the driver's side, or in the driver's seat, and I drove away with his car. You know what I mean? And there was this whole high speed chase thing, you know. And spoiler alert: I didn't get away. They got me, you know. But apparently, at one point, and I honestly don't remember a lot of it from that point on. some, kind of flashes of memory. But I did read, it's an interesting thing when you read about yourself in charging documents. And so a lot of what I know about what transpired after I stole that car, I know because I read about it, in the police officer's words. And at one point I pulled over and they would get out of the car, all this stuff. And as they started to approach the vehicle, I was like, yes, they're out of the vehicle. And I took off, Problem was, it was a cul-de-sac. So I was like, well, damn. So I went around that real fast, and next thing I know, I'm faced with a police officer, one kind of to the side of the road and one standing in the middle of the road, and they both pulled their service revolvers, and I floored it. What I mean? It took me years to understand that if I'd have killed that guy, I would have been okay with it, because that's who I was, And he dove out of the way, quite literally, and that's when the high speed chase ensued. And so they got me, and they pulled me out of the car, and they cuffed me, and then they went to town, and they started like beating me pretty good. Now here's the thing: I don't really think much about that in and of itself, and this is certainly isn't some commentary on police brutality. But back in the 90s, if the cops beat you up pretty good, they would let you go home. So they cuffed me and start beating me. I'm like, yes, I'm going home tonight. And then they put me in the car and took me to the station, and I'm handcuffed to this table. I'm like, but wait a second, And I'm indignant because they didn't let me go, let alone that I just almost killed one of them. And that's how my perception of the world was. So eventually that, hey, they get me processed in and all that stuff, and they're like, hey, you can make your phone call now. So I did what any other tough guy would do. I called mom, and I mean, we all know that a mother's love is a mother's love. And I would love to stand here and tell you that my mom said something to the effect of, do you want me to come see you? Should I call a bail bondsman? Should I call a lawyer? Anything like that. She said none of that. In fact, what my mother said to me at that moment was, good. At least now I know where you're at. Hung up the phone. And here's the thing. There was nobody left to call. Not after that. That's a dark day when mom quits. That was a dark day. And like I said, there was nobody left to call. So I went back to my bunk and I sat down. And I put my head in my hands and I thought to myself, yeah, what happened? What happened? It wasn't supposed to be like this. I just wanted to take the edge off. I just want to blow off some steam. What happened? And then came this question that absolutely terrorized me. What are you going to do now? And for the first time in my life, I did not have an answer for that question. And I believe that because I didn't have an answer for that question, a window of grace opened. Nobody came running down the hall with a dozen donuts saying, we got an AA meeting in here, or anything like that. But I did get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous while I was incarcerated. And I was released. That was in January of 1998. And I was released in July of 1999, July 10th, my sobriety date. And I'd love to tell you that I stayed sober that whole time, but that's not true either. When they transferred me my last 5 months that I was incarcerated, they transferred me to this work release, and within 2 weeks I picked up again. I didn't get caught, but I did have what's described in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and in our literature as a moment of clarity. And I had a very singular thought, much like that insanity thought that I described earlier about you've never taken a legal drink, only this one was slightly different, and it scared me. It said, if you can't stay sober in a controlled environment like this, you don't have a prayer when you walk out that door. And I knew that was true. And I don't know why it scared me. I'd never been sober out there really, anyway. So why did that scare me? Well, the reason why it scared me is because I knew that I could hold my breath for a certain amount of time. But eventually I had to come up for air. And I knew if I came up for air, quote unquote, which means I need relief, that something was going to happen. And that was my experience. And so it wasn't like I was, this is a theory. This is exactly what had always happened to me. So anyway, that occurs. I start going to these meetings while I'm still incarcerated. One in particular was in Bethesda, Maryland. It's called, well, it's not there anymore, actually, but it was called Saturday Night Special. And I went to this meeting because it was a young people's meeting. I was like, you know, it might be nice to be around some people my age. And that, I go to this meeting, and these people, I mean, they were happy. But they were like AA gross happy, you know what I mean? Like, get away from me happy. Yeah, I can't stand you. And they'd ask me these terrible questions, like, you want to hang out? Like, with you? No, I don't. And the weirdest thing would occur. Every time I'd be around them, I'm like, oh, I got to get away from these people. They're driving me crazy. Oh, they're making my skin itch, you know? And then I would get away from them, and I couldn't wait to be around them again. I just couldn't wait for the next time to see them, even though I couldn't stand them, and I didn't even understand why that was happening. I had no idea. But there was something magnetic about these people. And anyway, you know, fast forward a little bit. It's July 10th. I get released in 1999. July 10th was a Saturday morning, and I went to that Saturday night special meeting that night. And I raised my hand, and I said, "My name is Travis. I'm an alcoholic. I was just released today, and I don't know how to live. Can somebody please help me?" As the words are coming out of my mouth, I'm trying to pull them back. You know. Like, no. Where I come from, you don't say things like that, you know? And people, then of course, the other side of that is that I knew people were like going to come talk to me. I didn't want to talk to them, you know? I desperately wanted to talk to you, but I also desperately did not want to talk to you. And anyway, this guy named Mike, he comes up to me after the meeting, and to hear him tell this story, I was leaning up against a post smoking a cigarette. So cool, I might freeze to death, you know. And he said, "Hey, you're going to the meeting tomorrow night." I said, "I would like to." He said, "I can give you a ride." I said, "That'd be great." So we exchanged information, and he started to walk away. Took a couple steps, he stopped, and he turned around and said, "Hey, listen, some people are coming to my house tonight to watch a movie. You're welcome to come if you'd like." I said, "Hey, I might do that. I don't have any other plans." And man, like it was. Like it was yesterday, I could see it in my mind's eye. He started to turn again, and he stopped, and he turned back, and he looked me dead in the eye, and he said, "I want you to know that's an open invitation. You are always welcome at my home." And the thing is, that may not sound like much to you, but God, it had been a long time since somebody said something like that to me, you know? And in that moment, he got me. He got me. And I had no idea that my whole life hung in the balance of those few seconds. I had no idea, you know. So he would let me call him, and I would call him, and he would say things like, "Travis, it's going to be okay." I'm like, "Really?" He said, "Yeah. You going to the meeting tonight?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "All right, I'll see you there." And after about 2 weeks of this, I called him as I would do often, because he would say stuff like, you know, we'd be getting off the phone, "Hey, I really appreciate you calling. You think you could call me tomorrow?" Like, "Yeah, I can do that. I can do that." And so after a couple of weeks of this, I called him and I said, "You know, Mike, I need a sponsor." And he said, "Yes, you do. You are bad sick." And I'm thinking to myself, that didn't go the way I thought it was going to go, you know? And so I redoubled my efforts, and I said, "So I was thinking about asking you." And he said, "Oh yeah, go ahead." Like this time, you know, like what the? So I had to say the words, "Will you please sponsor?" You know, and then he asked me a question. He said, "Are you willing to follow directions?" And I knew what the correct answer was, and I knew what the truth was, so I was faced with a dilemma. You know, and I lied and said yes. You know, and that man used that against me for the next 19 years. Thank God. Thank God. And he would say just terrible things to me, like, you will go to meetings, you will sponsor people, you will work the steps, you will do service. And I would think to myself, I will light you on fire if you don't stop talking to me like this. But instead, what came out was, okay, Mike. Okay. There's the big mystery. If you want to, if you're struggling with AA, just try to cooperate with the process. Doesn't mean you have to like it. I didn't. And I got to tell you, almost everything my sponsor had me doing seemed completely unrelated to my problems. I'm like, yeah, make coffee. I need a loan. You know what I mean? And anyway, so that started this whole thing. And I, next thing I know, I'm like setting up chairs and I'm making coffee and I got busy and I had some real dilemmas. Like I did a budget and I looked at what I made and I looked at what my expenses were. And I called him and told him about this, and told him about my numbers. And I said, I have $7 left per month. And he was like, well, that's going to be tight. And I was like, no, I, that doesn't count for food. And I was legit like, I don't know, how's this going to work? But I didn't miss a meal. I can tell you that much. I did not miss a meal. And we figured it out. And I had restitution I had to pay. I had urinalysis. I had group counseling. I had all this stuff with probation officer and all this stuff, right? And I honestly cannot remember the details of how I got all that stuff completed. But I do know I made a lot of coffee. I do know I mopped a lot of floors. And the thing that the people of Alcoholics Anonymous promised me, they said, if you get busy here, I guarantee you will take care of that stuff. And you will, there is an end to trouble in Alcoholics Anonymous. They promised me that. And I was like a career criminal at this point, And I'm like, I don't think you know who you're dealing with. And they knew exactly who they were dealing with, And thank God. Thank God. And what started to happen to me is that I started to have an experience that was different than all the other experiences leading up to this when it came to sobriety. And I started to believe. I remember being about, I don't know, 90 days sober, 3 months, somewhere in that range, where I had started to get really involved, started to get to know people, knew their names, they knew mine. We would talk regularly and hang out regularly and all this stuff. And the thing was, I was lying about my sobriety date. I was saying that I had been sober the whole time I was incarcerated. I had not. And I had this crazy perception that, length of sobriety was some sort of a status symbol in AA, which, I mean, I guess, I mean, I don't know. I like to say my sobriety because you never know. They may end up with some sort of a pension. I want to get credit for my time in, but the reality is all it means is that I have, that many years of sober experience. That's what that means, So I didn't want to let that go. And then I go to this event. They call it, we're doing it actually in November. It's called the Men's Advance. And I got honest, and I didn't get honest by virtue. I want to be real clear about that. I told my the guy named Tom, he's my best friend at the time. I said, Tom, I got to tell you something. He said, what? I was like, so I actually picked up when I was in the work release. He said, really? I said, yeah. And he goes, have you told anybody else this? I was like, no. He said, have you told your sponsor? I said, no. He goes, well, you've got an hour. And I was like, an hour for what? He says, either you tell him or I will. And I'm like, this rat bastard, right? Like, what? Thought we were friends. And but here's the thing. He cared more about my sobriety than our friendship. And I had another friend named Pat, and he and I made a pact. We got sober a couple months apart, and we had a pact that we were willing to sacrifice the friendship to save the other's sobriety. And it did come to that, by the way. That was not easy. But that's the thing is once I started to I got honest about that, and the thing about getting honest that night is I slept through the night, which whatever, right? Except I hadn't slept through the night in years. And I didn't again for another couple of years. My first three and a half years sober, I slept about 3 hours a night. I woke up with nightmares almost every night. Things that I had done, things that had been done to me. And it was just awful. I remember having a conversation with my grand sponsors, and I said, "You know, Frank, I sometimes think I might have to drink just so I can get some damn sleep." And he told me, he said, "I can't promise you when, but if you stay here and you stay the course, it will stop." You know, I didn't believe him. And it took another 2 years after that conversation, but they did stop finally, you know. And the thing about getting so or getting honest and having that good night's sleep and all that, I remember the next day, that was a Saturday night at that event. And I remember the next day was a Sunday, obviously. And I started to think to myself, like I started to have this idea that maybe, just maybe, I could stay here and do this. That maybe, just maybe, that stuff you people in AA are talking about, this great life you're talking about, maybe, just maybe, it's available to me. You know, I know it's available, but maybe it's available to me. Like, I never really believed that before. And it was like such a fragile thing. I didn't even tell anybody and I didn't want to because I was afraid if I said it out loud, it would go out. Truly. And there was something about AA where I felt like I could have a different life, a life that guys like me don't get to have. But I also knew I had to do some things. My sponsor was very clear about that. And so I got busy. I came up with this idea. You know, if I sponsor more people than him, maybe he'll leave me alone. He didn't, you know. He's just like, "I think you need one more." And I'm like, this guy's out of control, you know. But the thing about all of that is that doing all the service, trying to help people and everything else, I was crazy busy. I didn't sleep a lot and I was always running, but I wasn't drinking. I wasn't drinking. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, if things get really hard and life becomes chaotic, I know what pulls me out of that because I have that experience and thank God. You know, I'd love to tell you that I got sober and my family got sober and my dog got sober and everybody's just so happy and life has been grand. And for the most part, that's true. I mean, I've had great successes. My life is beyond anything I thought was possible, especially for a guy like me. But I've also had life. You know, when I was a little over a year sober, my mom was diagnosed with cancer. A woman that I had seen be sick, and I'm talking even common cold, maybe five times in my life got really sick, lost all her hair. And I remember we would take turns taking her to her chemo appointments. And when it was my turn, I'd go pick her up. On the way there, we'd be talking and, you know, all this stuff. And I got to spend some time with my mom. And man, those were quiet rides home. And I would take her home and I'd get her in the house and get her in bed, make sure she had everything that she needed. And I would go to leave and I'd sit in the driveway in my car and just cry. Big tough guy, you know. Killed me seeing my mom like that. You know, but I got to be a son to my mom. And that was the thing I had robbed her of for so many years. But I got to show up and be a son to my mother. And you'll hear a lot about living amends, and there's nothing wrong with that. Okay. I want to be really clear, but I don't ever use the term living amends, especially when it comes to my family. And the reason why is because that makes it like it's some sort of a task. I really look at like my relationship with my sister. I'm just trying to be her brother. You know, I'm trying to be my parents' son. And if I do that, the rest of it takes care of itself. You know, and so maybe that's splitting hairs, maybe it's semantics, but that's how I look at it. And that served me well. So that was one thing, right? And she's still alive. She did survive and everything. She was never the same afterwards. Fast forward a period of time, when I was about 5 years sober, my grandfather was murdered, and it's still an unsolved homicide in the state of Ohio. And that was like a weird situation, you know. Look, I know it's all shocking, also. It's not that shocking, you know. My grandfather was shady on a good day, and that's just the reality of it. And that doesn't mean he deserved to be killed, but he was always kind of mixed up in something. My whole life. I don't know the details, but it was a little bit shocking to find out what happened. And it's not something that I talk about a lot. You know, I just don't. But for the first time in my life, I remember looking at my father, it was his dad. And I remember looking at my father and I had this thought of, oh my God, he just lost his dad. And for it wasn't about me, it was more about him. And that had never occurred to me before. And so something was happening. About a year later, my dad had the first of two heart attacks. That scared me. I was about a year sober and I had taught myself how to write code. I got this job as a developer my first day. My first day, the company declared bankruptcy. I said, you gotta be kidding me. Like, what is happening? So I took this other job, right? And so I don't know, it was maybe 9 months later, that company declared bankruptcy. I'm like, what am I, like the black widow of corporations? What's going on here? And it's just an adventure. It's an adventure. And obviously that was unsettling to have that happen, but I stayed sober. I didn't miss a meal. I lived indoors, and anyway, so things happen, and I've had great successes and dismal failures. Nothing quite like some love on the rocks to make you look at things, love on the rocks in AA. Me and this woman, we dated for about, I don't know, it was 5 years, something like that. But we dated like six times over 5 years, so that tells you something, and anyway, eventually we split, and nobody gets custody of the meetings. So we had to figure out how to be around each other and sober and effective in AA, and that wasn't always easy, but we figured it out. And we're actually still great friends, and only in AA, right? So I'm running out of time, and there's a couple more things I want to tell you about. The first of which happened, I guess it's been about seven years ago or so. I had to have some extensive dental work done, which, whatever, right? One of the things that they gave me for the pain was ibuprofen, which, again, whatever. Except for if you have an ulcer that's really bad. I didn't know I had an ulcer. So about a week after that, I woke up in the middle of the night in pain. And very quickly, a matter of minutes, it went from pain to excruciating to agony to what's happening. And I woke my wife up and I said, I think I need you to take me to the hospital. Now, if you get me to a doctor, you're doing something. You get me to a hospital, and so she knew if I'm saying I need to go to the hospital, it's bad. And she always tells this story. It's just like, started kind of getting ready. I'm like, babe, we got to go. And she's like, you're so calm, though. Like, what do you want me to do? Freak out? I mean, whatever. But the pain got so bad, I literally couldn't breathe. I was almost like hyperventilating. And I said, just call the ambulance. So they came and, emergency trip to the hospital. And here's the thing. I had to have emergency surgery. I was in the hospital for 5 days, which you give a man some time to think about things. I was almost 18 years sober at that time. And that ride to the hospital was about 10 minutes. And it really stands out to me in my memory what was going on during that 10 minutes. And probably more astounding is what wasn't going on. I did not think about the petty rivalries at work. I did not think about what I want my next vehicle to be. I did not think about the next raise that I was going to get or the next home I wanted to buy or any of that. I remember thinking to myself, my wife's name is Beth. And I said, if I can have 10 more minutes with Beth, I'll do anything. I'll do anything. If I can see my kids again, I'll do anything. Anything. And so it really gave me some perspective about what's important in life, at least to me. And like I said, after that, I was in the hospital for 5 days after emergency surgery, the whole nine, and I couldn't eat or drink anything. And I looked at my life, and here's the thing. When I almost died when I was, right before I turned 21, I had so much regret, so much regret. And here it is, many years later, my life is extremely different. And I didn't have regret, but I remember having this feeling there's so much more I want to do. I had cleaned up enough of my past that the regret and the guilt was mostly gone. There's still things I've done that I certainly don't like to think about or relish. So not that the stuff I was doing was bad stuff, it was just the same stuff. And so I needed to make some changes. And one of the things that I did is I changed sponsors. That was hard. And that guy Mike, I mean, he and I are still great friends. We've traveled together even since I changed sponsors. Still, he's more like family than anything else at this point. But I had to get a new sponsor, and that wasn't easy. And I had to resubmit to, okay, well, what is it that you want me to do? And do those things, just like when I was new. About 3 years ago, my best friend, you probably remember him, Billy, a guy named Raleigh. And Raleigh and I got sober about a year and a half apart, and we did not get along early on at all. But over time, we had always heard this saying of, you don't get to pick your friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. You get to be friends with who's left. And that's what happened with he and I. A lot of the people that we ran with when we were new had left. Raleigh and I were still here. And somehow, some way, we just started to become friends. And he called me up. He was working down in Huntsville, Alabama. And he called me up one Saturday afternoon. And like I said, we weren't close. We didn't really get along that great. And we're talking, and he called, "Hey, how you doing?" I'm like, "I'm fine. What's going on?" And so this conversation goes on for a few minutes. And then he said, "Travis, do you know why I called you?" I said, "Raleigh, I gotta be honest with you. I have no clue. Truly, no clue." He said, "I knew you'd pick up the phone." One of the greatest compliments I've ever been given. So he and I became friends after that. And what we found was that we had, though the details may be different, we both had a darkness within us that was really hard for us to deal with at times. And we always would be really honest with each other. Anyway, he was 20 years sober, and I guess he couldn't, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, but I think he was suffering from some untreated alcoholism. And he couldn't take it, so he put a gun in his mouth and he pulled the trigger. And that's one of the hardest things I've ever had to deal with. The guy was like, he was like a brother to me. In fact, we were so close that his sister insisted that I be listed in the obituary. And I spoke at his funeral and all that stuff. And I mean, that was like one of the things. I remember I went to a meeting, and I said, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to do this. And that's the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. It doesn't matter what's going on. If you come here and you say, "I don't know how to do this," people will help you. They may not know either, but you can figure it out together. And the problem for me is that if I try to figure it out on my own, I come up with bad ideas. They're usually worse than the problem, And so, in our book, it says that love and tolerance is our code. And I want to let you in on a little secret. If you have love, you don't need tolerance.
Yeah.
And I'm not always there, but I strive for it, for sure. And the other thing is, kind of to my point about Sharon, I don't know how to do this. Whenever I've needed you the most, you've given me your very best. Every time, without exception. Whenever I've needed you the most, you've given me your very best, without exception. And I could never, ever repay that. But I can promise you that I will spend the rest of my life trying. Thank you for allowing me to be here.
Yeah.